I'm going to call this meeting of the House Committee on Economic Development for Wednesday, February 27th, 2019, to order. And just for those in the audience, we'll be moving things around on the agenda to accommodate people's schedules who will be testifying or not testifying. So first, before we go to a public hearing on House Bill 2613, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2132. So Melissa, would you describe this bill, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2132 does the extension of the Oregon Cultural Trust tax credit for 6 years. This is a subsequent referral to revenue, the House Committee on Revenue. And so we have a revenue impact statement that's been issued and there's no fiscal impact.
Okay, very good.
Chair Lively, I move House Bill 2132 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Representative Bonham moves House Bill 2132 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, please call the roll.
Representative Barreto?
Aye.
Representative Crazy?
Aye.
Representative Helm?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Oh, excused. She'll be back.
Representative McEwen?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Excused.
Representative Wallen?
Yes.
Representative Witt?
Excused.
Witt just was.
Vice Chair Bonham?
Aye.
Vice Chair Fahey?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Just wanted to make sure. Okay, the motion passes. So we still don't. So Representative Smith's not here. Okay, so I will open a work session on House Bill 2173.
Although, did you want to wait for March?
Oh, excuse me. That's right. Okay. I'll close that work session. I told Rep. Marsh I'd wait for her to come back. Come on, somebody help me here. You got to think so much. Okay.
So we're waiting for Rep. Smith.
We're ready for Rep. Smith.
Yeah, try it again.
Do you want to start the information?
Why not?
Sure.
Okay. So I think we have it now. So I'm going to open an informational meeting on brownfields in Oregon. So we have Karen and Cheyenne, I believe, are here to offer some input and testimony. Thank you very much for being here. And if you'd just introduce yourselves for the record. You have a... There we go.
Our slide presentation, we have a DEQ Business Oregon.
Oh. I'm glad it's not just me, then it's okay.
We'll just proceed without if we have to. We did submit them yesterday, but that's okay.
We'll proceed without. Chair Lively and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cheyenne Chapman. I'm a legal policy analyst in the cleanup program, which is part of the Land Quality Division in the Department of Environmental Quality. Related to our topics of brownfields today, I serve as DEQ's Prospective Purchaser Program, or PPA Program, coordinator. DEQ and Business Oregon work collaboratively to facilitate cleanup and redevelopment of brownfields statewide, and DEQ working on technical cleanup issues and liability protections, and Business Oregon working on funding. Today, Ms. Homolak and I will present a brief introduction to brownfields in Oregon and the work that DEQ and Business Oregon do to facilitate brownfield cleanup and redevelopment. The legislature has taken an active interest in brownfields over the last several sessions, including recapitalizing Business Oregon Brownfields Fund in 2015, authorizing governments to create land bank authorities also in 2015, and authorizing local government property tax incentive options for brownfield cleanups, which was in 2016. We appreciate this opportunity to present to the committee today and hope that this information will be helpful as the committee moves forward. We first wanted to address a definition of brownfield. Brownfield in Oregon law is defined as real property where expansion or redevelopment is complicated by actual or perceived environmental contamination. Both federal or Superfund law and state cleanup law were designed decades ago to ensure that contaminated properties were cleaned up by responsible parties. For many properties, this approach has resulted in cleanup and redevelopment. However, in some cases, holding all past and present site owners and operators jointly and severally liable, while intended to ensure cleanup, now functions as a barrier to cleanup and redevelopment. Where there are no longer any identifiable responsible parties, or when responsible parties have no ability to pay, contaminated properties can remain in limbo, especially because any new party coming on the scene as a prospective purchaser is unlikely to take on the liability and uncertainty associated with the contaminated property. One of the slides that we'd hoped to share with you indicated where brownfields are located around the state.
We do sort of have one up there.
Oh, thank you. Excellent. Yay. Hey. Miracle. And this slide presents a snapshot of known brownfield properties throughout Oregon. These sites were pulled from DEQ's database of cleanup sites. Brownfield properties can include large industrial properties and numerous smaller businesses located in most communities across the state, such as automobile fuel stations and dry cleaning establishments. Brownfields are located in urban and rural areas around the state, and they may present simple or complex issues when considering the property, the project, and the parties involved. Most brownfields have what we refer to as legacy contamination resulting from past practices. These past practices may have been standard operating procedures back in the day and often resulted in what we would consider today to be an unacceptable release of a hazardous substance into the environment. Such environmental contamination, or even potential or suspected environmental contamination, may pose a significant barrier to redevelopment, reuse, and repurposing of these properties. Many brownfields are located in prime locations, central to downtowns, along high traffic corridors, placed to access infrastructure and transportation, which helps explain why these properties were attractive for development in the first place by whatever activity resulted in the legacy contamination. There are multiple benefits to cleaning up and appropriately repurposing brownfields. Ms. Homolak and I also hope to give some examples of how the Department of Environmental Quality and Business Oregon work together to facilitate brownfield cleanup and reuse. DEQ primarily works on the regulatory side of cleanup, including offering liability protection tools, and Business Oregon primarily works on advocacy and funding for brownfield cleanup and redevelopment. Responsible parties may enter DEQ's voluntary cleanup program or independent cleanup program pathways, which, when successfully completed, usually results in a no further action determination. This determination is often a critical step towards redevelopment. Prospective purchasers may enter DEQ's prospective purchaser program to negotiate a PPA, with the purchaser gaining liability protection in exchange for providing a substantial public benefit. Both DEQ's program and Business Oregon's programs recognize the same types of public benefits that may be achieved through successful brownfield activities, specifically cleanup, funding for cleanup, returning property to productive use, and any important public purpose. Ms. Homolak will explain Business Oregon's brownfields program, and share some success stories that have involved both DEQ's prospective purchaser program and Business Oregon's funding sources. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Chair Lively, committee members, thank you for this opportunity to present Business Oregon's Brownfields program today. For the record, my name is Karen Homolak, and I am the Brownfields Program Policy Specialist for the Oregon Business Development Department, otherwise known as Business Oregon. As Ms. Chapman presented, Brownfields is defined in ORS 285A-185-1 as real property where expansion or redevelopment is complicated by actual or perceived environmental contamination. And as the map of Oregon illustrates, thank you, City of Portland, brownfields are evidence in every community throughout the state. While DEQ's role is primarily that of regulator, Business Oregon's role is that of funder, generally providing the gap financing necessary to bring about the successful redevelopment of these properties. Business Oregon manages two funds, the Brownfields Redevelopment Fund and the Brownfields Cleanup Fund. The Brownfields Redevelopment Fund, often referred to as the BRF, was created through passage of legislation in 1997 and is capitalized from proceeds by the sale of state lottery bonds. The BRF is able to assist both public and private entities with financing to address environmental assessment through cleanup of contamination on real property. The Brownfields Cleanup Fund, referred to as the BCF, is capitalized with a U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Brownfields grant to the department. Unlike the BRF, the BCF is only able to assist public and private entities with financing to clean up contamination on real property. Moreover, given the federal source of the funds to capitalize the BCF, the eligibility of both the applicant and the property are subject to satisfying federal cross-cutting regulatory requirements. Both the BRF and the BCF, sorry for the acronyms, I'm trying to, we didn't make it easy, are structured as revolving loan funds that are able to provide grant funding opportunity to public entities for publicly owned property projects. Both funds offer low interest, flexible loans with consideration to the applicant's ability to repay, creditworthiness, economic benefit of the project, and use of the proceeds as defined in the project. The maximum term of the loan cannot exceed 20 years from the date of loan closing. Both funds require Business Oregon to consult with DEQ prior to making a funding decision, as well as to ensure appropriate DEQ regulatory oversight and or review. Thus, Business Oregon works closely with DEQ to ensure that a project's scope and scale of work will not only achieve environmental compliance, but will also meet the needs of the redevelopment project. As I mentioned a moment ago, there is a slight difference between the two funds when it comes to project eligible costs. Basically, the BRF, the state fund, is able to assist with environmental assessments, that's phase one, phase two environmental site assessments, related studies such as hazardous building material surveys. It also provides a small Brownfields integrated planning grant to support the redevelopment of a brownfield and cleanup. The BCF is only able to assist with funding the cleanup related activities on a project, on a property. And it is a matter of determining the needs and characteristics of a project in order to determine which fund is best able to be of assistance for that project. In 2014, a return on investment analysis was completed, which demonstrated that brownfields and redevelopment of brownfields spurs economic growth. A summary handout of the return on investment analysis is will be available on OLIS. We will make sure that that is available.
We're working on that right now.
It is?
We're working on it right now to get it.
Great. In brief, the analysis examined 51 brownfields redevelopment projects and determined that every $1 of state investment leveraged $116 of other funds, resulting in $2.3 billion in economic activity, creating 8,900 on-site and indirect jobs, and generating $19 million in tax revenues to the state. Over and over, Oregon's communities are demonstrating that reusing properties stigmatized by contamination from past uses is beneficial to the community, to the economy, both local and statewide, and to the health of the environment we live in. Redeveloping these properties is not for the faint of heart. They are not easy, nor are they inexpensive, as they seldom come without a surprise or two. I would like to take a moment to speak briefly about two projects, the City of Hillsborough's fourth main project and the City of Coos Bay's Coos County History Museum, which illustrate the positive effect redevelopment of brownfields can have on a community. First of all, the City of Hillsborough, and I have some great shots too, so hopefully that slideshow will show up before and after of that gives you a sense of what there was and what there is at the end. The City of Hillsborough Fourth Main Project, it was completed in May of 2014. It is a mixed-use complex capping a 16-year journey from land acquisition to redevelopment. The property, located in the heart of the city's historic downtown retail district, was jointly purchased in 1998 by the city and Metro, just as plans for the West Side Max Light Rail line were beginning to take shape. The intent was to hold the property until the time and market was right, and then to engage an experienced development team to create a transit-oriented, high-density, affordable mixed-use redevelopment. In 2012, the city selected the proposal presented by Tacola Properties to jointly develop market-rate rental units with an adaptive reuse of the first interstate building, bank building, which was on the property. And there was also some former gas stations and a number of other previous uses on that piece of property. Concurrently, DEQ negotiated a prospective purchaser's agreement with Tacola Properties to provide liability relief, in particular third-party liability protection, and the city entered into DEQ's voluntary cleanup program. Work included remediation of three underground storage tanks and appropriate removal and disposal of contaminated soils at the same time the underground parking garage was being built. Construction of 71 market-rate apartments, 3,800 square feet of additional retail, and remodeling of the former bank building to house a local professional theater company. Funding for this project was provided by the Downtown Hillsborough Urban Renewal Area, Metro Transit Oriented Development Program, Vertical Housing Development Zone, and the State's Brownfields Redevelopment Fund, which provided a loan of $300,000 to the City of Hillsborough. Metro funds of $545,000 were combined with additional city and Metro funding for a total of $2.2 million in public investment. Total construction cost for the redevelopment was $14.5 million. The community benefits of this project are many, including 71 units of much-needed downtown housing, approximately 125 new residents, creation of 52 permanent jobs, construction estimated to have created 140 jobs, and $25 million in new spending. The return of property to the tax rolls and generating new funds for investment in other development projects. And most importantly, new residents supporting local restaurants, shops, and the arts and culture scene of downtown Hillsborough. My other example is the City of Coos Bay, this Coos County History Museum. The Coos County Historical Society was founded in 1891. It is the second oldest historical society in the state of Oregon. From 1958 until 2014, the society operated its Coos County Historical and Maritime Museum on land donated to it by the city of North Bend. By the late 1990s, the museum facility in North Bend was obsolete, but the society lacked the resources to improve or replace the existing facility or to build elsewhere. In late 2000, the society received a private, unsolicited donation of Tootsie Roll stock, valued at more than $800,000, which came with one stipulation, that the funds be used for construction of a new museum located along Highway 101. In early 2004, the City of Coos Bay offered the society the former Central Dock property, which the city had purchased from Coos County. The county had earlier obtained the property through tax foreclosure proceedings. Located along Highway 101, the Central Dock site was situated directly on the waterfront, serving as a gateway to the city's historic waterfront and presenting the museum with extraordinary opportunities for waterfront interpretation, encouraging community gathering, pedestrian activity, and waterfront redevelopment. Redevelopment of the site was not without its challenges. The property was original tidal wetlands
and had been filled sometime prior to 1900. A 60-foot-wide dilapidated wooden dock structure covered the intertidal riprap edge of the property. A concrete slab and retaining wall extended along most of the perimeter of the site. And a double-wide rail spur bordered the western boundary of the property. Moreover, a long history of industrial commercial uses had left a legacy of metal and petroleum contamination that needed to be addressed. The society faced many hurdles before realizing its dream. Before moving forward with construction, it opted to rebuild staff capacity and programs, hire a new executive director and collections manager, launch a new education program, and then, in 2005, begin a capital campaign to raise money. Additionally, the society worked with DEQ, first to negotiate a prospective purchaser's agreement to limit its liability, and then to determine cleanup options. Through removal of contaminated materials during construction and utilizing design and institutional controls, the museum's footprint and parking lot caps the entire upland portion of the property. In May 2014, 18 months after breaking ground, the museum opened its doors to the public, and it's an amazing facility if any of you have had a chance to go there. In conclusion, brownfields impact every community around the state. DEQ and Business Oregon work collaboratively to promote cleanup and reuse of brownfields. Successful brownfields cleanup and reuse requires many factors: time, money, and certainty. Ms. Chapman and I appreciate the opportunity to have shared this information about DEQ's and Business Oregon's brownfields programs. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions of members of this panel? Representative Barreto, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on the map that you showed up there, I was surprised to see all that blue, and then looked like all of Portland was contaminated. But you said the brownfield description was actual or perceived environmental contamination, and so I get the petroleum contamination and all of that that's gone in the past, but what other kind of contamination do you include under hazardous substance?
I can answer from a DEQ perspective, and then perhaps Ms. Holmelak would like to add. In our DEQ databases, we have a general cleanup database, Environmental Cleanup Site Information, or ECSI database, that has many of the sites that I referenced in my remarks, the industrial sites, automobile service stations, metal plating facilities, all kinds of sites that have had a release of a hazardous substance in the past and have been brought to our attention and are in the system. We have approximately 6,000 of those sites in the ECSI database. We have a separate database for underground storage tanks or leaking underground storage tanks. When a tank has a leak, it has a release of hazardous substance into the environment, and now we have a cleanup situation. So we have in our LUST database, or leaking underground storage tank database, approximately 12,000 to 13,000 of those around the state. So most of these maps are drawn from DEQ databases, cleanup sites, and underground storage tanks.
Right, and along with petroleum or the hazardous substances, which Cheyenne mentioned, I work with a lot of projects that when I'm in a down, I'm working with an applicant who's from a downtown looking at old buildings. Oftentimes you have a lot of hazardous building materials from past installations, asbestos, lead-based paint, old fluorescent baluster, light balusters, which will have mercury, fire exit signs will often have that. So there's any number of contaminants which in excess are hazardous.
Levels, I would assume.
Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Lively. Thank you for your presentation. And just, this is a very important topic that you're talking to us about today. I have two questions. What is a perceived environmental contamination?
Representative McEwen, Chair Lively. If you're driving down the street and you see a property, and I'm sure a lot of us do that, where we see a fence that's around it, there's a lot of, it's blighted, the windows are boarded up in the building. If there is a building there, there might be a lot of accumulated garbage. Someone looking at that piece of property, perhaps interested in buying it, would say, I wonder why the market hasn't moved on this piece of property, particularly if it's got a great location. and that would trigger you perceiving that maybe there was a past use. And so what you're going to do is you're going to perform an environmental phase one environmental site assessment.
Which costs money.
Which does cost some money, okay. But it is the least expensive of all the environmental due diligence activities that you can undertake as a buyer.
I see. So it's more cosmetic. You're talking about cosmetic aspects.
That triggers that perception.
Blight is the important word that I'm hearing you say.
Yes.
It's a blighted property. Secondly, I remember having this conversation in meetings prior, and particularly in communities that have some age to them. They could be have former dry cleaners that used chemicals or former camera shops that used chemicals. My father had an office supply business, and he had three men that did nothing but work on typewriters and 10 keys with big vats of solvent, mm-hmm. which I'm sure in the 50s was fine but isn't so fine anymore. And I know in small towns, we find those little corner businesses that are contaminated just because of businesses that were there in the past that were using those types of things. So it's not necessarily an industrial sector is kind of what I just wanted to add that.
And Representative McEwen and Chair Lively, if I might add, the other aspect of perceived contamination or properties that are stigmatized because of possible contamination relates to the uncertainty that surrounds properties that have known or suspected environmental contamination. Mm-hmm. And the whole process of attaining some certainty through a phase one as an initial step, a study to try to show whether or not there are any recognized environmental concerns that would lead one into further investigation, as opposed to no recognized environmental concerns with more assurance that this property is indeed ready for redevelopment.
And I would be remiss, Chair Lively, in not thanking you both. Coos History and Maritime Museum was a labor of love for a community that took decades to accomplish, and we appreciate the work that you did in helping us begin to change a blighted waterfront. This is the anchor tenant of a waterfront that is now going to transform, and we're very proud of the work that was done there. Thank you for your help.
Great. Grazing.
So I actually am really interested by this, and I also found the map to be a lot more spotted than I thought it might otherwise be. So to just kind of clarify from my own thinking, and this is my first exposure to this particular topic, you said that the 6,000 sites in the database were brought to your attention. I'd like to have a sense of how these things end up being dots on that. Yeah. Brown fields made me think we were going to talk about industrial sites and the land and the water and all those kinds of things. I did not realize that it is also corner shops and buildings and all of those kinds of things as well. And so what I'm really trying to understand is if something looks like it's blight and whether or not it might be in some commercial sense stigmatized, does that draw it into this phase one review and in some ways increase costs for people to transfer this property and in some way get it on a list that it's hard to get off of?
Yeah.
So can you talk to me about process for how these dots came to be dots on that map?
Certainly, Representative Drazen and Chair Lively. I would be happy to provide sort of a snapshot or an overview, and I would also be happy to provide more detailed information to follow this up.
Perfect.
And I will mention that every year for the past 30 years, the Environmental Cleanup Program submits a report in January of every calendar year to the legislature on how the Environmental Cleanup Program is going. And we have a whole list of our the process that sites go through for cleanup, how you're placed on the confirmed release inventory list, how you are off that list, and so on. So I won't attempt a large explanation right now, but I will say a couple of things. First, in Oregon, as is mentioned in our annual report, there is no requirement that sites with legacy contamination be reported to DEQ. So our ECSI database is not necessarily a comprehensive database. If you're in it, you can get some information about whether or not a site has some issues. If it's not in it, that's not a guarantee that there aren't some issues with respect to a site. Over the past 30 years, DEQ has gone through phases of work in terms of identifying sites, doing site assessments. Sites come to our attention many times when a site is ready to transact or when there's some interest in transferring the site to a new owner. Then that's the time when everyone has an incentive to go find out some more information about potential environmental contamination. And as responsible parties work with sites, they can come into our independent program or our voluntary program. As prospective purchasers come to our attention, they can come work with us on that basis. So I hope that that, at a high level, at least begins to fill in how the sites end up in our database. And Karen, maybe you'd like to add? Okay.
Thank you. And I'd also like to thank you for gently telling me to check my email. Thank you.
Representative Wallen.
Thank you. I do have a couple of questions that I hope will be quick. One, as you clean them up, does the dock come off this map? And what rate at which are they coming off and then also being added? Because it sounds like you're adding them at the same time. So what's the dynamic nature of this map?
I will add from a DEQ perspective, we have actually had that question come up in another committee earlier this session, and we are doing some background work. There are quite a different, there are different ways that one can count whether you're on the list, on a confirmed release inventory, whether you've been issued a no further action letter. There are a variety of indicators that we can use. So I'd like to get back to you on that with a more specific answer with the meaning of those terms, if that's acceptable.
That's fine. Thank you. And then my one other question is, what kind of budget are you talking about that Business Oregon puts in to the cleanup? What is the dollar? And how does that compare to the volume you have of requesters to get cleanups?
Representative Wallen, Chair Lively, the Brownfields Redevelopment Fund, which is the state fund, was capitalized in 2001 with $500,000. It received another infusion of about $200,000 a couple years later, and was finally in 2005 recapitalized with $9.6 million. In 2015, it received an infusion of $7 million additional dollars. To date, that fund has been capitalized. It's a revolving loan fund with the grant component. It's been totally capitalized at $16.5 million. It has generated revenues to date. Its revenues to date are $25.2 million. So that's roughly an increase of $8.7 million. There's a current cash balance of $6.8 million. And of that $6.8 million, there is an unobligated amount that's available. In other words, it's available for projects right now of about $3.6
million. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, very good. Thank you very much. We appreciate
the
information.
Thank you.
So I'm going to close the informational hearing. And Representative Smith, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2613. So, Senator Frederick, we delayed Representative Smith first, and then we'll get right to yours. Thank you. Listen, you tell us what House Bill 2613 is all about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2613 requires the Oregon Business Development Department to retain a consultant to develop a master plan for county fairground capital construction and to report on the plan to the Legislative Assembly during the 2020 regular session.
Very good. Welcome, Representative Smith.
Chair Lively and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith. I have the distinct pleasure of representing a handful of rural counties from Umatilla all the way to Wasco. And so thank you for allowing me to be here. The reason I'm bringing House Bill 2613 forward is I have an opportunity to serve as the vice chair of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. And I also serve on the Capital Construction Committee, which allocates capital dollars throughout the state of Oregon. And over the last probably 6 or so years, I've seen a trend where our counties throughout the state of Oregon really are stepping up and requesting assistance for capital needs within our county fair grounds. And what House Bill 2613 does is it provides a systematic approach to where the legislature can see what are those capital construction needs, whether it's in Wallowa County or down in Jackson County, Coos County, or any other county in the state of Oregon. What I'm asking you to do is to send this bill to Ways and Means and to allow us to use this as an instrument to assist Business Oregon in creating a position either through contract or through limited duration to go out and do an analysis of what are those capital needs within our fairgrounds and report back to us in 2 years. So that way, as we receive the multiple requests throughout the state of Oregon, we can prioritize them based upon need. It's a very simple piece of legislation, Mr. Chair, and I hope it'll get favorable consideration.
Representative Barreto, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Greg, for bringing this forward. Yes, Wallowa County, Union County, you got yours in Umatilla County. But no, I think this is very much needed around the state, just like, you know, what they're doing with the state fair, too, and trying to make it a viable a part of each community. So thank you. Appreciate it.
Any questions for Representative Smith? Thank you very much for bringing this forward, and I apologize for the delay in getting you on.
No, thank you.
So, shall I close? Okay, so I'm going to close this hearing on 2613. We have another person to testify, but I'm going to open the hearing so Senator Frederick can testify. So, I'm going to open a hearing on 2699. Welcome, Senator Frederick. You want to testify? Okay. Oh, Melissa, please, the bill.
Now I have to adjust my
sorry.
Stuff. That's okay. We're keeping up here. Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2699 modifies the brownfield property tax incentive law to specify that a brownfield property granted special assessment or full or partial exemption of improvements or personal property under the law is also eligible for any other special assessment exemption or partial exemption for which that property is eligible. We have a -2 amendment on OLIS, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm Lou Frederick. I'm a state senator from District 22, North and Northeast Portland. I've come before you to support House Bill 2699. This is a continuation of my concerns about brownfields. In every one of your districts, I can almost guarantee you, you have about 100, at least 130 brownfields. You may not know, you may know them by the fact that they are often old gas stations, dry cleaners, a number of other mechanic shops, that kind of thing. They're empty right now. Many of them are, they're sitting there, and they have a possibility of actually becoming more productive. And so this is since I began in the legislature, I began working on brownfield redevelopment as much as possible. I continue to do that. This is and I do that, and I'm often surprised. In fact, I was surprised near Representative Barreto's stomping grounds last spring when I went over to Baker City, and we were in the Baker City School District. The Baker Technical Institute was giving us a tour. We sat in a room, and a young lady got up and said, with her head down, she was very shy, and she said, "Yes, well, I do this. This is what I do. We found out that the Baker schools were given a brownfield. They didn't know it was a brownfield. They were given some property. They found out it was a brownfield, and they decided that they would find out what a brownfield was, and they went and they investigated, and then they investigated what kind of contamination could be there, what kind of cleanup was needed. And once they got that done, they got somebody else to do the cleanup, but they got it cleaned up, and then they sold the brownfield and bought another brownfield. And they learned how to clean up brownfields. They have a full class that does just that. So she's telling me this story, and I was reminded of my 2011 bill, one of my first bills that I passed, was cleaning up brownfields and allowing the DEQ to sign off on when a brownfield was cleaned up. That's what they were using, that particular bill. So I was floating about 5 feet above the ground because I never thought that it would be used in that way. We have we need to have other tools to continue to clean up these spaces. Many of them are orphan sites. They're the people who own them are no longer around. The companies that own them no longer around. Sometimes they attempt to try to find them in other ways. But this is an attempt to try to find other ways to clean up the brownfields. And I encourage you to support this particular bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Chair Lively, Vice Chairs Fahey, and bottom members of the committee. My name is Katty McHugh, and I represent House District 9 down on the South Coast, Coos Beatty Yahats.
And first, I want to thank the good senator for joining us today on this bill. We've been working on these for quite some time now, and this is a bill that I'm very proud to bring before you today. House Bill 2699 clarifies that local brownfield property tax incentive programs may work in concert with more than one tax incentive program to provide multiple public benefits. I've been working, as we mentioned, on brownfields with the Oregon Brownfield Coalition and a group of diverse stakeholders, urban and rural, which I'm very proud of, since 2015. And it involves the public, the private, and the nonprofit sector to help clean up these sites that you have learned about since this meeting started a bit ago. In 2016, I was a chief co-sponsor of House Bill 4084, which authorized local governments, if they chose, to provide property tax incentives for the cleanup and redevelopment of these brownfield sites. Last year, Marion County became the first jurisdiction in the state, Senator, to pass an ordinance implementing that property tax incentive. And this year, the city of Portland is joining suit and is in the final stages of developing and enacting their own local ordinance. So it's working. House Bill 2699 will allow a property owner to simultaneously participate in the brownfield tax incentive program and in other tax incentive programs when providing multiple public benefits that are defined in the bill through cleanup and redevelopment of these properties. I consider this a technical fix. It improves the economic development tool available to local jurisdictions to clean up brownfields and advance community goals. And you heard a couple of examples today. There is a dash two amendment which provides some technical clarification, and I'm going to let Mr. Knoll explain the dash two amendment to you from the city of Portland, and he will be up here in a minute to enlighten you as to what the dash two amendment does. I also want to make sure that I give a nod to Randy Tucker. He's been working on this brownfield project with us now for years, and he's been stalwart, smart. He understands this well, and he's just been a champion for the work that we've been trying to do in moving this legislation forward that's going to help your communities, all of them, in the future, go deal with all those little blue dots and the yellow dots that you saw in that map today. So thank you for your time, and I respectfully urge your support of House Bill 2699.
Okay, any questions for these two witnesses? Doesn't look like it. Thank you, Senator, for being here, and Representative McEwen, thank you. So if we're keeping up here, I'm gonna close this hearing. I have one person to testify on House Bill 2613. So I'll close the hearing on 2699 and reopen the hearing on House Bill 2613 and call Kelly Ross to the podium. And thank you for your patience.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the committee. My name is Kelly Ross, and I'm here to represent the Oregon Fairs Association. I've submitted written testimony, so I'll just be very brief and let you know that it probably shouldn't come as any surprise that the Oregon's county fairs are extremely supportive of this bill and appreciate Representative Smith bringing it forward. County fairs and fairgrounds today are enjoying a popularity that they haven't seen in many years. In 2018, they reached a total attendance high that of over 1.75 million people attending county fairs. And then beyond the fairs, last year, non-fair activities attracted 4 million, over 4 million people to the fairgrounds. So one bad aspect of that, all that attendance, is it is wearing on the facilities, and facilities that in many cases are very old, what you might even consider ancient. And that is also coupled with the fact that the fairs and counties are strapped in their financial resources and haven't been able to make an investment in long-range capital facilities planning. So this would have significant benefits for counties, not only in terms of looking at future state support, but generating local support for those improvements. So we definitely recommend your support of this and moving it on to Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thanks for sticking around and testifying. Anybody else on House Bill 2613? Okay. Close the hearing on House Bill 2613 and
reopen the hearing on House Bill 2699. So I'm going to call Eric Knoll, Jen Bildersee, and Tom Armstrong to the podium, please. Just identify yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively, Vice Chairs Bonham and Fahey, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Knoll with the City of Portland. Thank you for hearing this bill today. I'm here to briefly provide you an overview of the bill, the Dash 2 amendments, and then really want to turn this over to my colleagues, Jen Bildersee from the Bureau of Environmental Services and Tom Armstrong from the Bureau of Planning Sustainability at the City of Portland, to provide more background on the City of Portland's implementation of the Brownfield Property Tax Exemption Authorization, and provide a few examples of how this bill would be implemented. I first want to extend a thank you to Representative McEwen and Senator Frederick for their remarks in support of the bill, and call your attention to a letter on OLIS from signed by individual members of the Brownfields Coalition in support of this technical fix bill. House Bill 2699 plays off of House Bill 4084 passed in 2016 that allows local jurisdictions, if they so choose, to adopt local property tax exemption for the cleanup and redevelopment of a brownfield property. House Bill 2699 will allow developers to participate in more than one tax incentive program while encouraging the cleanup and redevelopment of brownfields, specifically for the purpose of encouraging the use or the implementation of multiple public benefits. For example, the development of affordable housing on a previous brownfield site or the expansion of a business within an enterprise zone. We do also consider this a technical fix to a bill that was created as part of a multi-year process and was a product of bipartisan bicameral support in the 2016 session. Broadly, tax exemption programs are an important tool for local governments to incentivize public benefits, like the cleanup of brownfields or the development of affordable housing or the expansion of businesses through enterprise zones. Specifically, a tax exemption tool can address some of the many different brownfields that come in all shapes, sizes, and complexities by providing a but-for tool. As in, the cleanup and redevelopment of the property would not happen but for the exemption being available. The Dash 2 amendments before you today are what I would like to call a technical fix to the technical fix bill. It's a product of our conversations, particularly with the Department of Revenue and the Assessors Association, taking into consideration their ability to implement the provisions of this change and how local ordinance, an implementing ordinance from the local jurisdiction will communicate how multiple incentives being used on the same property tax liability will be conveyed to the county assessor so that they have clarity. The language in the amendment also reflects updated engagement with the drafters and removes some extraneous language that we believe caused confusion and that could be better addressed in a local ordinance. And with that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues and would be happy to answer any questions at the end. Thank you
very much. Welcome.
Yeah, Chair Lively, Vice Chairs Bonham, and Fahey, members of the committee. My name is Jen Bildersee. I manage the City of Portland Brownfield Program. We're a program at the Bureau of Environmental Services at the city. And I'm gonna, you may be familiar with my first slide.
Thank you for loaning it.
So the timing was great today. I'll just hit a couple of highlights for you from this map. There are over 13,500 brownfield sites all across the state of Oregon. Every city and county in the state of Oregon has numerous brownfield sites. And what I often have to start by explaining, but we've now covered and many of you on your own have observed, these aren't just large industrial sites and large former mills, places like that, which are really tricky brownfields, but they're also small commercial sites that many of us walk, drive by every day, even live near, sites that were gas stations, dry cleaners in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s, and now carry that legacy. What does that look like in Portland? So as Representative Bretto observed, we are a sea of blue on here. In Portland, it's over 900 acres of brownfield sites that are affecting our community. And
each of these brownfield sites is a very complicated puzzle. Each one has a unique set of challenges. There are some things in common, but as Karen Homolak said, they all have surprises. And so there isn't one tool that we can develop as a state or as a community that's going to address all the brownfields. We need a toolbox. And we were very fortunate in 2016 that the legislature had HB 4084 for us, this enabling, authorizing legislation that local communities could develop a tax incentive, a property tax incentive, as a tool for brownfields. We really appreciate the leadership of Representative McEwen on that and the sponsorship of Representative Lively. And this is a tool that in Portland we're really anxious to put to use to help address some of our sites. So the good news is that brownfields are full of opportunity. In Portland, brownfields have become pretty much anything you can imagine a site becoming. So the two sites pictured here, one became a local commercial bakery, and another became an affordable housing development that had a number of support services. These were both sites that had really sat vacant for, I think in both cases, decades before we were able to do something to redevelop them. So the City of Portland is part of the Portland Brownfield Coalition. This is a coalition of statewide stakeholders convened by Metro. And this was one tool that we were really anxious to move forward. And so after 2016, we began convening a working group to set up Portland's program to develop this incentive. And we spent a long time really carefully crafting what our incentive would look like in the City of Portland, because the state legislation leaves a lot of room for local communities to develop an incentive that's appropriate to their own community. In Portland, the proposal that we're bringing forward is a property tax abatement for 50% of the eligible cleanup costs, so costs that are spent on the cleanup activities. Certain properties can receive up to 100% of their cleanup costs in a tax abatement if they meet criteria that they are high priority projects for the City of Portland. So sites like affordable housing, industrial sites, other city priorities can receive up to 100% of their cleanup costs as tax abatement. There is a per project cap in our proposed program. Those site owners who have contributed or caused the contamination on their site are not eligible for this incentive. And sites will have to work with DEQ to ensure appropriate cleanup is conducted in order to take advantage of our incentive. As we have been working to set up the program, one thing that we realized was that there have been some unanticipated consequences of the way the original legislation was designed. In particular, when we began discussion a number of years ago about what the state legislation could look like, one thing we all agreed on was that we didn't want to allow for double dipping. And what we meant by that was, if a site owner is receiving a different type of incentive for cleanup, they shouldn't also be able to take advantage of this tax incentive for cleanup. Unfortunately, in the writing, that got written so broadly that it now could be interpreted as a cleanup and redevelopment that is taking advantage of any other type of incentive for any other aspect of the project can't make use of this incentive to address the brownfield part of the project. And that really undermines our intention of kind of leveling the playing field between contaminated sites and uncontaminated sites. So what we're looking for here is a clarification that we still don't want to allow double dipping on cleanup costs. So if, for example, a site is receiving an EPA brownfield grant for the cleanup, this is not an incentive for them. But we do want to encourage properties to take advantage of the multiple types of supports that are there so that we can see robust redevelopments of our contaminated sites. And Tom is going to talk a little bit more about exactly what this looks like.
Yes, thanks, Jen. Chair Lively, members of the committee, I'm Tom Armstrong. I'm a supervising planner with the City of Portland, and I work on our economic development policies, and particularly focused on industrial lands issues. But I want to talk about two programs where we see an opportunity to combine both the brownfield tax exemption with other tax exemptions to I think what was said before, to achieve multiple public benefits and policy outcomes. The first program I wanted to talk a little bit about is the Enterprise Zone program, which is mainly focused on employment type investments. There's 73 of these enterprise zones spread across Oregon. Typically, this is property tax relief for new capital investments, and it runs for about 5 years, depending on the program. And as you can see from this map, they're spread across the state. And for Portland, we've had ours in place since 1996, and we've leveraged $2 billion worth of investment and have created or retained 5,000 to 10,000 jobs. And this is a little bit better map than the sea of blue, but this is a map of the city of Portland's enterprise zones. And the black squares on this are our brownfield sites. And as you can see from these, they're really correlated with our industrial areas along the river and out by the airport in northeast Portland. And as well, you know, in a couple of years ago, 2012, I believe, we expanded the enterprise zones out towards East Portland and some of the neighborhood commercial districts in East Portland to try and encourage economic reinvestment in those neighborhoods as well. You know, this tax incentive and the ability to sort of layer and combine tax incentives are particularly important in industrial areas where even new industrial development, the property values are a bit lower, and the property tax liability is a bit lower. And so, you know, whereas our analysis has shown, like a new commercial mixed-use project generates about $300,000, $325,000 in new tax revenue per acre, an industrial property may only be about $15,000 per acre. And so for a 10 or 15 year brownfield program in an industrial area, that's about $150,000 to $200,000 that can offset cleanup costs. But our analysis showed even an average sort of medium brown site can cost up to $300,000 in an acre to clean up. So even, you know, there's a mismatch where a developer or an employer who might be looking to invest in a brownfield site, the enterprise zone program isn't enough, but if we're able to combine the brownfield with the enterprise program, that can be enough to make the project go. The other example I wanted to point to is some of the housing tax exemption programs. There are 21 cities across Oregon that have a vertical housing tax exemption program. Portland itself does not have one. We use the multiple unit limited tax exemption program for affordable housing. Portland and Eugene have that exemption. And again, this is an example where you know, in Portland, if a developer develops a building under our inclusionary housing program and sets aside 10% of the units as affordable housing, we give them a tax exemption on those units. But yet there's still room and there in the tax liability to cover brownfield costs. And what you see here on this table is if you had a site that had, say, $500,000 worth of brownfield cleanup costs, you know, that there's still tax liability, property tax liability there that can be offset and cover those cleanup costs. And especially in sort of mixed-use commercial projects, the values involved mean that those brownfield cleanup costs get covered really quickly, and that new development gets back on the tax rolls in a relatively short time frame, you know, a 2 to 3 year time frame. And can have 8 to 10 times more property tax revenue generation than the vacant, dormant brownfield property where it was. So by being able to combine these two exemptions, we can really accelerate reinvestment in some of these longstanding stagnant properties. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony and thank you for the opportunity to consider this bill, and we're happy to answer any questions you might have.
Do members have any questions for any of these witnesses? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when a potential buyer looks at one of these properties, and then they would get a site evaluation and probably a number that it would cost them to clean these up, if they should then decide not to purchase the property because the cleanup is too costly, can they recoup any of that money that they spend on evaluating the property?
Well, typically that's part of the due diligence of the real estate deal, and often lenders require at least that phase one environmental assessment before, you know, as part of that lead up before they'll even grant financing on a property like that. So it's like an appraisal or any other costs, you know, so it that is money at risk.
Okay. Follow up on that. So then if they do that phase one study and then get a cost of cleanup, they don't do it. Does that carry with the property so the next person that comes along to buy it could use that same study?
You know, that those studies really don't get recorded anywhere. Okay. And oftentimes sellers will do their own phase one and include it as part of the marketing materials. I think Karen Homolak had mentioned, you know, just the uncertainty around these properties. And so
they want to do their own.
But even then, the phase ones just sort of scratch the surface as to what was there. It doesn't, you really need to get to the more expensive phase two studies where you actually start digging in the ground and doing test wells and trying to figure out how big or how deep that contamination goes before you really get into how much costs are really going in. The idea behind this exemption is a prospective purchaser knowing that hey, I'm going to be able to cover half my costs or most of my costs, gives them more certainty that I can make the numbers work on this deal, so they're willing to put up that money, front that money as part of the due diligence to get to yes on a deal. And it just gives that added comfort that I'm going to be able to figure this out.
Very good. Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Drazen, please.
Can you clarify for me the number on there that's the brownfield money? Is that, in this particular example, would that be like the state's revolving loan fund portion of what's available?
No, and I think that's what was key about the concept of double dipping.
Yeah.
Like, so in this example, there's $500,000 worth of cleanup costs. Mm-hmm. If they didn't get an EPA grant or Business Oregon assistance, they could tap this property exemption mm-hmm. program to be able to cover those costs, and then, but, you know, especially for a commercial mixed-use property, the tax liability on that, they can get those costs back really quickly, and then they start paying more of the full taxes on the property.
So this assumes that that other portion isn't in here at all?
Right.
Thank you. Just
right.
Confirming.
Any other questions? Doesn't look like it. Thank you very much for testifying. Yeah, I have two more people have signed up. So Eric Kessler and Garrett Rosenthal, please come to the microphone and introduce yourself and provide your testimony. Thank you.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, for the record, Eric Kanzler representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors, here to support the Dash 2 amendment to the bill. And as you've heard already, the Dash 2 amendment is really in large part an effort to ensure that the administering local government or potentially port clarifies for purposes of tax assessment how they wish for the multiple exemptions to be handled. For example, should they be additive? Should they be stacked? Do they wish to take the higher of the two? And the bill allows for local control from the local governments and the ports in that fashion, which is fine from us. From our perspective, I should say that we don't have a position really on the underlying policy of the bill. Our interest and support for this bill is really due to the fact that the Dash 2 adds in the sort of clarity that we wish to see. It's very much appreciated. It's not always easy to administer tax exemptions, and so the extra effort that the bill's proponents went through to ensure that we could do our work easily and cleanly and avoid potential disagreements and lawsuits is very much appreciated. So we support the bill as amended by the Dash 2. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sir, please.
Chair Lively, Vice Chairs Bonham, and Vice Chair Fahey, and also a special thanks to Representative Marsh. The last time I was here, I had to borrow her glasses. This time I brought my own. Her glasses are more stylish, but mine work just as well, I hope. Anyway, my name is Garrett Rosenthal, and I live in rural Washington County. I was an environmental consultant in Oregon. I believe you have this testimony, for approximately 45 years before retirement. And in that capacity, I had the opportunity to work on a lot of remediation in many situations, including many brownfield sites, hazardous waste, whether it's metals or solvents or petroleum sites or lumber mills, pentachlorophenol and so forth like that, or transformers and so forth. I was involved in the smaller sites as well as the larger sites, and I'm speaking today based upon my consulting experience and my belief, which is shared by Tax Fairness Oregon, in the cardinal principle of polluter pays as enshrined in the environmental laws. I'm also a strong advocate. I don't want to seem as though I'm opposed to cleaning up brownfield sites. I'm very much in favor of it as a ways to improve economic situations, particularly in mixed neighborhoods. Clean up brownfield sites is also very good for the consulting industry, as I'm sure you're aware of that. Having been a consultant, I'm quite aware of that myself. The current law was passed. Tax fairness observed that prudent buyers could also be getting a bargain by buying, by having a lowered purchase price. We were concerned that many jurisdictions might not carry out or might not have the capacity to carry out adequate due diligence in finding private monies or pursuing all the public programs, and we still have that concern. As a result, public funds would be used to subsidize the gains in private developers at the expense of funding for education and social services. As I'm sure you all know, a private tax abatement, approximately 40% comes from, basically has to be repaid by the state to balance the overall cost. I don't know the exact number on that. So the lack of due diligence is not due to bad intent, but it's due to the fact that a lot of different entities do not have the capacity or the familiarity with brownfields remediation landscapes. And you've heard testimony that's very complicated. It involves a lot of different considerations, a lot of different aspects of how you go about developing these sites. It's the fact that the current law, though well-intentioned, continues this tendency to give away tax revenues with little control in both the short and the long runs, which could reduce the amount of money available of revenues coming in. I've listed there, which you've heard in previous testimony, a number of the programs. It's not meant to be inclusive or totally expository on what the different programs are, but there's a number of programs, the Orphan Site Program, the Oregon Coalition's Brownfields Cleanup Fund, the US EPA Grant Program, and so forth, and the governor's budget has now allocated $10 million for a brownfields cleanup, which is, as you heard, is about $200,000 per cleanup is a good estimate. That doesn't, there's 5,000 sites, you can do the math. So some sites, insurance coverage may also be available, and I know of one particular site where there was a $500,000 cleanup that it took on the last minute they found insurance coverage which could pay for it. So the effort needs to be made to do the appropriate archaeology, what they call an insurance archaeology, something many jurisdictions simply do not have the experience with and often do not have the staff to pursue. It's a question of using the easiest tool that's available, and we're somewhat concerned about that. So we strongly believe that Brownfield should be giving a helping hand, and the existing programs are the way Oregon should probably continue to help fund Brownfields, not vice versa. To that end, and I would say we don't advocate eliminating tax abatement, but minimizing it for the benefit of the state, we have proposed what I would consider an amendment and suggested that it would be in Section 12AE as follows. A requirement that the owner shall provide reasonable demonstration and documentation that the credit to be allowed against taxes otherwise due under ORS 316, 317, and 18 are requested only subsequent to unsuccessful efforts to secure funding under existing and applicable laws, including grant and loan programs administered by the DEQ, Business Oregon, Oregon Health Authority, US EPA, et cetera, and that due diligence has been carried out in seeking private funding from applicable insurance coverage.
This would be a requirement that then they have to at least certify that they've gone through some hoops to look at the other options of funding before we step into tax dollars. So I regret that we didn't suggest this in 2016. We did provide testimony at that time, but I think that this would make House Bill 2699 quite more effective and a little bit more protective of our revenues. Thank you for your opportunity to testify, and I'll be willing to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for either of these witnesses? Doesn't look like it. Thank you very much, both of you, for testifying. So I have nobody else signed up to speak, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2699. Representative Marsh.
It's unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow me to be recorded as voting on the motion to House Bill 2132. It will not change the outcome of the vote taken.
So Representative Marsh requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow her to be recorded as voting
aye.
on the motion on House Bill 2132. It will not change the outcome of the vote. Are there any objections? So ordered. So, committee, I'd like to stand at ease for just a second, please. So, here's the question.
Hold on. You can just turn off. Okay,
I'm going to call the meeting back to order, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2173. So, Melissa, if you would describe the bill, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2173 creates the Oregon Broadband Office within Business Oregon, and it repeals the sunset on the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council. You have a dash two amendment on OLIS, which does some membership adjustments to the Broadband Advisory Council and has one refinement for the council's responsibilities. The bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. There is no revenue impact, and there is a fiscal impact statement that's been issued.
So you're ready, it's ready for you to work today.
Okay. Chair Lively, I move to adopt the dash two amendment dated February 20th, 2019.
Representative Bonham moves to adopt the dash two amendment dated February 20th, 2019. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Garrido?
Aye.
Representative Friesen?
Aye.
Representative Helm?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative McEwen?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Excused.
Representative Wallen?
Yes.
Representative Witt?
Excused.
Vice Chair Bonham?
Yes.
Vice Chair Fahey?
Yes.
Chair Lively?
Aye. So motion carries and the dash two amendment is adopted.
Chair Lively, I move House Bill 2173 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
So Representative Bonham moves House Bill 2173 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, please call the roll.
Representative Garrido?
Aye.
Representative Raiden?
Aye.
Representative Helm?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative McEwen?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Excused.
Yeah. Representative Wood?
Excused.
Vice Chair Bonham?
Aye.
Vice Chair Fahey?
Aye.
Chair Lively?
Aye. So the motion passes and it's as amended and it's on its way to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any other business to come before the committee today? Okay.
It was an error.
It was an error.
It didn't count.
Okay, hearing none, we'll adjourn.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry.